From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, one school superintendent on balancing the need to keep kids safe from COVID with the risks at staying at home.
Our goal from the beginning has been to coordinate a sustainable and a responsible and a safe reopening of our classrooms, and we're absolutely determined to do so.
Also, Detroit extends its moratorium on water shutoffs.
That moratorium began in March, and they haven't shut off anyone since then, but those bills are not canceled. Like, people are still, you know, being charged for the water, they're just not having to pay it right now.
And how youth in the LGBTQ community find strength through chosen family.
It's not just a great group of friends. When I transitioned at 17, my parents were not eager. They were Mexican Catholic folks. They were loving, but it just was not hitting home for them.
Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the show, Detroit announces there will be no more residential water shutoffs until at least 2023.
To us, we see this as not only a Detroit issue, we see this as a Michigan issue. And we believe that water affordability can be solved not only in Detroit, but in Michigan, and we can be a model to the nation.
More on that story coming up later in the hour. But first, the COVID pandemic has posed so many challenging tests for even the most well-resourced Michigan communities. There are many school districts that have made an astonishing pivot to virtual learning on very little notice. All the same, these schools are helping kids and families through one of the most difficult periods in living memory. And as we heard yesterday, some have questions about whether virtual learning is the right choice for Michigan's kids in this moment. Dr. Janice Swift is the superintendent of the Ann Arbor Public School District. Dr. Swift, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here. Thank you for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit about what the pandemic has been like for Ann Arbor schools?
Well, this has been a very challenging time, really, for everyone, for our students, parents, for our teachers and staff and leaders, for our families and our community. It's just an exceptionally challenging time as we navigate this 100-year public health crisis. I just appreciate the work of everyone involved to do our very best work for children. And yet the situation is quite concerning, as we all know.
As we heard on the show yesterday, there's a group of physicians that has written a letter asking the board and the district to consider allowing some kids to return for face-to-face instruction. Have you seen their statement?
I have.
What did you think?
There is absolutely no doubt that children are better served in face-to-face instruction. You know, April, that is what we are all hardwired to do, is to have our children in classrooms, in schools, with teachers, eyes on, face-to-face, in person. And yet, that doesn't tell the whole story, the entire story of what we're addressing when we think about a responsible and sustainable reopening to in-person instruction. We have planned from the very beginning that small groups of our most vulnerable students would be among the first to return to in-person learning. And yet, just like everything else we're experiencing in this pandemic, this is really about a systems approach. Right now, at the highest point so far of this surge of cases, our community spread is at a level where even staffing classrooms is an incredible challenge. We know that children need consistency. They need regularity. They need rhythm and routine. So our job is really to look at that system. And that's our job collectively, to think about available testing and timely results, to think about the impact of the vaccine that will start in Michigan next week. We are indeed very close to a better day, and yet our current challenges are immense with regard to the reopening of school doors.
You said something just now. I wanted to ask a bit more about the fact that keeping classrooms staffed would be a big challenge right now. Can we unpack what that means? Is the problem that there are enough people who are testing positive that school buildings can't be adequately staffed? Or is it that there might even just be enough people who've had a contact with someone who's tested positive that makes that difficult?
I appreciate that question, and it is absolutely both of those components. We noticed in October in our own community, the shift in the increase in the level of community spread makes it such that that combination of individuals who are personally impacted by a positive test and those who are impacted by a quarantine requirement, the combination of those two makes it impossible to properly and responsibly staff our classrooms and schools. Our goal from the beginning has been to coordinate a sustainable and a responsible and a safe reopening of our classrooms, and we're absolutely determined to do so. Just like, though, when we think about reopening the economy, we really have to consider first things first. And our first priority as a collective and as a community is to realize a reduction in that level of community spread so that we can responsibly get our professionals and our students into classrooms together.
You alluded to the fact that the district has indeed planned all along to at least try to get some of the most vulnerable kids back into face-to-face instruction when it is possible. What have you planned on that might be an appropriate time for that return? Like, what would trigger such a thing?
What we've known from the spring is that this pandemic is not following a calendar, and that we are going to need to be responsive. So our plans for reopening have been in place. Our team is poised and prepared. And yet we want to see, and you heard it in the MDHHS briefing on Monday afternoon with Governor Whitmer, you heard those key and critical components that we want to see a downturn in the level of community spread. We want to see the case numbers reducing so that we aren't on what you've seen across the country on that open, close, open, which is extremely disruptive for students and for families and for staff. We want to coordinate a safe and responsible and sustainable reopening. You know, April, just last week reported in Detroit, the top six categories for identified outbreaks in Michigan. The category number two on that list, right behind long-term care facilities, is K-12 schools. So our reality right at this moment is that this level of community spread is exceedingly high, higher than it's been at any time during this pandemic. And so we are mindful of the risks that we face in coordinating a reopening right at this time. And yet we are poised and prepared and planned and ready for when there is an opening in that level of community spread where we can responsibly begin with small groups of students. I also want to mention, April, that in addition, we have doubled down on our supports into the community. Every one of our mighty team of social workers and counselors and deans and intervention specialists and our community partners, we are all hands on deck so that our students and our families have those wraparound supports into the community. So we are not waiting for the day when our doors open. We are supporting our students. We are mobilizing every resource we possibly can to extend right into where our students are in their homes and into those virtual classrooms every day.
Just one more question. When we talked to Dr. Omkar Kathakayan, he made the point that there is a question about students' overall health. And that, yes, COVID is a risk, but there are a lot of other things happening to kids right now as a consequence of this pandemic that are very concerning to pediatricians. What would you say about trying to balance out the risk of COVID infection and further spread, which, again, you know, our hospitals are all but begging us and maybe actually begging us to stay in place and avoid more community spread, and the risk to children's health and the very real mental and emotional challenges to kids right now?
They're absolutely, April, it's a very serious concern. There is absolutely wide concern, and particularly from all of the members of our team, around the needs and the impacts of virtual schooling on our students and on our families. April, this is what keeps our team up at night, and it's what drives our work every day, is ensuring that whether we're in a virtual classroom or whether we're in a face-to-face, in-person, in-school classroom, that we are keeping our physical, mental health, social, emotional, all of those needs of our students, including our critical mission of teaching and learning, that we are keeping all of that in the front of our mind and as our focus. And you know, April, as we emerge through this pandemic during 2021, it is high time for a community and a countrywide conversation about that fabric of support that is needed for children and families. We need to come out on the other side of this pandemic with a new attitude, a new and deeper commitment to our children and to their future and to all of the needs that our families are experiencing. Because these needs, we know, have not just come on this pandemic. These are the needs our children experience every day. Regardless of a pandemic, they are certainly exacerbated by our current circumstances.
Dr. Janice Swift is superintendent of the Ann Arbor Public School District. Dr. Swift, thank you for your time.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
For young people who are part of the LGBTQ community, homelessness is a real and pressing problem. After a break, the new center that's taking an entirely different approach to helping them get housed and stay in supportive housing situations.
And if it wasn't for my chosen family, my gay family, I probably wouldn't have survived. And that's for many, many, many people.
More after a short break. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Ruth Ellis's legacy in Detroit is strong. An out lesbian and staunch LGBT and African-American civil rights advocate, Ellis passed away 20 years ago at the age of 100. The Ruth Ellis Center in Detroit continues her work and recently broke ground on a new facility that's going to house and help homeless LGBTQ youth, with a mural of Ruth Ellis herself right on the building. With us to talk about the work is Jerry Peterson, the executive director of the center. Jerry, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much for this opportunity to update you on our project.
What are you seeing among young people living on the street right now?
Well, one of the unique aspects is that young people say to us, how is this any worse than every other day of our lives? And I think it's important for your listeners to understand that the complexity and the trauma and the violence and rejection that many of the young people we serve who are experiencing homelessness and other barriers to success, this is their day-to-day existence. And so in some ways, they struggle to see how COVID makes their life any more complex.
How would you rate the risk of COVID compared with some of the other health threats that your clients might be thinking about or that you're trying to talk to them about?
Again, it's counterintuitive to most of us, but because this is such an isolated group of young people, which normally is a real detriment and it's something that we are concerned about a lot, that level of isolation from the general population seems potentially to have some kind of protective effect, that we're not seeing major instances of COVID-19 among the young people that we're serving.
Jerry, in the past, a heavy percentage of homeless youth are part of the LGBTQ community, precisely because their families could not or did not accept them. Society's gone through some pretty major changes in the past couple of decades. Gay marriage is legal, and some protections have taken shape around education and housing and employment. Not to say that the threats have evaporated, but it is a little different world out there. Have you observed any changes in the lives of the center's clientele?
The change is indirect, not direct. And what I mean by that is that there's a lot more funding and resources available to provide the services that our young people are looking for and need to stabilize their lives. Many of those benefits to the LGBTQ community in over the last decade, frankly, have primarily benefited white, middle, and upper middle class individuals. If you're living in poverty, you don't have a lot of resources, and you don't have a strong social support network, the levels of isolation and fear and violence are still really pretty high and haven't changed dramatically.
So what's the mission of the housing center and health clinic that you recently broke ground for?
So REC Center, Ruth Ellis at Claremont Center, is a 43-unit permanent supportive housing project. First and foremost, it will expand the availability of quality, affordable housing in the city of Detroit to people who are experiencing chronic homelessness. And so while our target group for the building will be LGBTQ young people, 18 to 25, experiencing homelessness, everyone who is referred to the building as a potential resident will have to go through Detroit's continuum of care and be assessed for chronic homelessness, and it will be determined whether or not permanent supportive housing is the best option for them. But the reason that we selected permanent supportive housing as the best option for the young people that we serve is that because of the layers of trauma and violence that they have experienced in their lives, any housing option for them that only provides intensive support for 12 to 18 months is not long enough support for them to overcome the negative impacts of the trauma in their lives. And so they may get temporary shelter, temporary assistance and support, but they cycle on into their own in market rate housing too quickly and end up falling into homelessness again.
I should probably explain that supportive housing refers to a very intentional approach that helps provide assistance with addiction issues, chronic mental health issues, or sometimes physical conditions, the kind of things that have driven people out of traditional housing and onto the streets to begin with. So what you're talking about is a system that provides caseworkers, case management, medical care, and things like that, right?
Correct. Absolutely. That's exactly what we mean. And that it's non-time limited. Meaning that, you know, we're hoping that 60% of residents will actually, within 3 to 5 years, will actually set goals, cycle through, and be in market rate housing perhaps within 3 to 5 years. But for many of the people who would reside in this project, it will take an extended period of time for them to be ready to be on their own in market rate housing.
What do you observe happening to young people who've spent time unhoused? What happens to them as they get older? Do many of them end up in a chronically homeless state?
Well, unfortunately, the data available for Southeast Michigan or anywhere in Michigan is extremely limited. So it's impossible to really say what the percentage is. We do know nationally that of all the people who are living on the street or experiencing homelessness, at least 2 out of 5 identify as LGBTQ, which is a much higher rate than for any other part of the population, and that's especially LGBTQ young people 18 to 25. So it's a much younger population than people think of when they think of chronic homelessness.
Sometimes what helps people who are living on the margins stay housed is having a social safety net. People who they can talk to, people who can drive them to a meeting, or who are willing to lend $200 for groceries and rent. How do you help people work on those relationships?
So for many of the young people who come to the Ruth Ellis Center, they are involved in sort of an underground family network called the ballroom scene. And the ballroom scene is organized in families of choice. There can be anywhere from 5 to 8 or 10 or more young people who are organized in the family, and their moms and aunties and uncles. And it is a very, very powerful social network that is the primary way that they support themselves and each other, being so isolated from the mainstream of the population here in the city of Detroit. And so what we really wanted to do in building this project is that, for example, because of those family relationships, if someone is homeless and is able to get housing, they might invite 5 or 6 of their family members to move in with them. And then a landlord gets upset and there's too many people in a 1-bedroom apartment or 2-bedroom apartment. And so there's eviction and cycling. And there's a lot of housing instability. What we are doing is building a project where the units themselves, studios and 1-bedrooms, are relatively small, 400 and 600 square feet, but there are large family gathering spaces and a lot of space in the building that really promotes that family of choice coming together and being able to support one another and be together, cook meals together in a full kitchen. And that's a critical aspect of the fullness of what it means for someone to be able to adjust to housing and stabilize their lives and be ready to move on.
Jerry Peterson is the executive director of the Ruth Ellis Center. Jerry, thank you so much for talking to us.
Absolutely.
We wanted to hear a bit more of what Jerry Peterson was talking about when he spoke of the social networks that keep people afloat. Liliana Reyes is someone the Ruth Ellis Center has helped, and she in turn has dedicated her life to helping other LGBTQ people of color through the center and her chosen family, and her work in a number of different ways. Liliana Reyes, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much. I'm excited.
Will you tell us a little bit about what brought you to the Ruth Ellis Center?
So the Ruth Ellis Center was like home. So I started my career in nonprofit fairly young. I went to college. I transitioned. I'm a Chicana Mexican trans woman. So I transitioned at 17. So almost right entering college, I transitioned. And I went through a lot. And so Ruth Ellis was one of the places that I would go to seek safety, to seek a space. There were people like me when my family really wasn't my supporters. And so when I started my nonprofit career, I never let go of the Ruth Ellis Center. And I went pretty high in my nonprofit career, where I was interim director and ED of many different things and nonprofits. The Ruth Ellis Center had an opening, and I wanted to be in a space where I worked mostly with people that look like me, Black and brown, trans people, Black and brown, LGBT people. And Ruth Ellis has always focused on the people that have difficulty getting services other places. So I came home.
You know, there's going to be some new information here for people who may not be familiar with how chosen families can be so critical to young people who are living houseless or just in a state of transition themselves. Could you talk a little bit more about the concept of chosen family and why it's so critical?
Absolutely. So sometimes folks who may not ever be LGBT or not have ever been socially isolated or not supported, a lot of people think it's just a great group of friends. And I want people to know it's not just a great group of friends. When I transitioned at 17, my parents were not eager. They were Mexican Catholic folks. They were loving, but it just was not hitting home for them. And I moved out. I had some safe places, but not places where I felt like I could be me. And if it wasn't for my chosen family, my gay family, I probably wouldn't have survived. And that's for many, many, many people. And so way back in the day, 40s, 50s, 60s, maybe even earlier, when brown and black LGBT people came out, because we tend to come out really young, a lot of our supportive systems way back in the day didn't support us to the extent that they support us now. And there weren't as many public resources. And so a lot of them were homeless, houseless at 11, 12, 13, 14. And some of them died on the street. Some of them went through addiction. And what seemed to happen is the older LGBT people who have been through that struggle, who were a little more stable. And by stable, I don't necessarily mean that they found great jobs because discrimination and racism was still there, but they were able to survive. Their resilience was really strong. And so they took on younger kids and they became their children. They became their mothers, their fathers, and their extended family when there wasn't any biological family. Gay families and chosen families are still ever so much important. And it does look different when you talk about Black and brown LGBT people and white LGBT people. Some of the reason chosen family happened is because of the racism that Black and brown LGBT people experienced. And so for me, I'm mother to lots of kids. And for some of them, I am the mother that is in their life at this moment. And for some of them, I've been the only mother in their life for a long time. Their families may not support them, and I've housed them, I feed them, I try to give them love and guidance. I'm not just a really great friend, I am their mother. And I'm their emergency contact. I'm the first person they call when something happens. I owe it to my children to be better than I could ever be so that they know that LGBT Black and brown person can do it.
I have yet to meet a parent who didn't want to get their brag on. Will you tell us about some of your kids?
Absolutely. I love my babies. I love my babies with all my heart. So a lot of my kids are also in the House of Ebony. And my son is the Midwest father, which means that of all the Midwest, he kind of holds all the chapters. So I want to make sure that I support him. My daughter is also in the House of Ebony. So my son is a gay Black man. One of my daughters is a Black trans woman, and she walks in the ballroom scene. She also does social justice work. I have another daughter who's a mother in the South for Ebony. She's a Black and Native trans woman. And honestly, a lot of the really big and upcoming legends or really popular folks in the scene are my children. And a lot of them come from the Flint area or the Detroit area. And they also work in social justice, so they're really changing the world while they're doing this. I have kids in North Carolina and Tennessee who are hairdressers and own their own boutiques and are social workers and HIV prevention case managers. And I have children who are very, very, very successful in the scene and in quote-unquote real life.
Liliana, you alluded to the fact that while family is what helps people living on the street get through their situation, that a lot of times it's not easy even for people who've made it and they're in their 40s and, you know, might be holding down some kind of work. And what we're talking about here is a lack of social structure for a lot of LGBTQ people. How do you think about the end game for everybody that you try to help at the center and everybody who the new supportive housing facility is going to help? I mean, are we talking about a house in the suburbs and a job, or is it still just about keeping people alive?
So what our goal is to help people figure out what their success looks like, what their value to themselves looks like, and then help create that. And that could look like helping people find a house in the city of Detroit. We need to be thoughtful about what success looks like. If we're buying into gentrification, if we're buying into racism, I don't believe that that's success. And so to me, success is being very thoughtful, is creating more artists and creating more entrepreneurs, young Black, brown LGBT entrepreneurs in the city of Detroit, bringing life back to the city through activism, through thought, through art. And for many of them, they tell us who and what they want. And sometimes it's to create some stabilizing spaces until they get to that dream and hope mindset. And so for that is getting them off the streets. But you also have to remember that because this is a community, if you place a community member far from their social context, they become socially homeless. And that's really scary. When people are used to a community helping them and making them feel good, and then people house them really far out, one need is met, but the other is not. And social isolation is a huge issue with suicide and many other things. And so our goal has always been to create safety for people and whatever their success looks like to kind of help that along. And so that's kind of what we do with our programs. With PSH, we went into the community, and it was a difficult process. honest, because the city of Detroit has its rules on how you can interact and all of this stuff. But we did our best to go into the community, to be thoughtful, to have conversations so that people knew who we were. And we hope by mimicking that, that we show the folks that we serve that they too should be thoughtful about the community that they live in. Because some of the things that other people think are just regular thoughts or regular actions are not. And those, what I kind of call them housing soft skills, are things that people have to learn. And if people are in generational houselessness or generational housing instability, where do they learn that? And so we try to help them with basically like don't have 12 people on a Monday night at 2 a.m. and have the music really loud just to be really thoughtful. And for some people, they're like, well, yeah, but for some communities, that's a norm. And so our goal is always to help them be better, be themselves and be authentically better, but they have to tell us what that looks like.
Liliana, we're going to let you go, but before we do, tell us a little bit about what the holidays look like for you and maybe how you're going to be spending them this year.
The holidays are rough this year. COVID has changed everything. I think this year I'm going to be spending time with my biological father and some chosen family at my new house. But it's not the same. People are separated. People are scared. It's rough. Also, my organization, not Ruth Ellis, but the other one that I run, Trans Sisters of Color Project, will probably be doing some Christmas delivery bags to keep the girls' spirits up.
Liliana Reyes is the executive director of Trans Sisters of Color and also works at the Ruth Ellis Center. Liliana, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Every year, thousands of Detroiters who do have a roof over their heads go without running water. Well, the city's moratorium on water shutoffs has just been extended another 2 years.
The city, Mayor Mike Duggan and Water Department Head Gary Brown, their tone has shifted.
More on that story after a break. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Late yesterday, the city of Detroit announced it would extend a moratorium on water shutoffs until 2023. Now, that's a dramatic shift from the city's stance in recent years. But as with everything else, COVID changes everything. Health officials decided that a lack of access to running water was an additional public health threat as residents were trying to protect themselves from the virus last spring. Activists have been saying for years that water shutoffs are a public health crisis in and of itself. Here to give us the overview of the ongoing issue is Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick. Hey, Sarah, welcome to Stateside.
Hi.
Can you remind us when and how water shutoffs began cropping up as such a major concern in the city?
Well, back in the summer of 2014, Detroit was in bankruptcy. It had an emergency manager, and the city began this campaign of shutoffs, saying for years the water department had not followed through on threats to shut people off. There were just a lot of people who weren't paying their bills and had accumulated a significant amount of debt. And so it finally followed through and shut off thousands and thousands of households. And there was a lot of criticism in terms of how that was done sort of very quickly and without a whole lot of warning for folks. And then there were genuinely a lot of people who, either because they were just chronically low income or because they had accumulated a significant amount of debt over the years, who couldn't pay. And the rationale at the time was that the city needed to get its finances in order, and that included the water department, and they couldn't let this sort of situation go on. But it really quickly developed into a crisis.
What were city officials saying at the time when they were getting this pushback? What were they saying at the time for why shutoffs had to continue? Was it just those strict rules of the bankruptcy?
Well, it was that, and there was the sort of transfer of power that was going on from the Detroit Water and Sewerage Department to the Great Lakes Water Authority, the long-term lease that the city made of its water and sewer systems, and just sort of getting the finances in order there, they said was necessary. But there seemed to be a pretty strong belief at the time that a lot of people just weren't paying their bills because they weren't getting shut off if they didn't. But I think it became pretty clear over time that there were a small but significant number of households that simply couldn't pay their bills or couldn't keep up with them, especially if there were folks that had accumulated a lot of debt. That persistent debt and having to pay off back debt along with current water bills really became a problem. But for a very long time, the city, Mayor Mike Duggan and Water Department head Gary Brown just said, well, that's the way it has to be, and we can't let folks off the hook for not paying their water bill. But obviously, their tone has shifted in recent months.
Right. Hey, what's the process that folks have to go through to get their water turned back on?
Well, it's supposed to be a fairly simple process in terms of contacting the water department. But if you're really behind on your bills, their chances are they're going to try and put you, or they're going to put you on a payment plan. And those payment plans have ended up being kind of a nightmare for a lot of folks, because in a lot of cases it requires a significant down payment, and you're trying to pay off your past bills along with current bills. And especially for folks who are really low income, and especially a lot of folks who the water department now says it's become clear that in a lot of older homes, there's significant plumbing problems, and a lot of people had leaky pipes, and that's why their water bills were so high. And until those problems were really tackled, and folks were just falling into sort of a deeper and deeper hole and really struggling, and then, you know, as soon as you get on a payment plan, you have to waive your right to challenge your bill. So for a lot of folks, it just ended up being this sort of nightmare cycle that they couldn't get out of.
Sure. I mean, that makes sense. Why pay hundreds, maybe even thousands, to get your water reconnected only to have very high water bills that might drive you back into the same situation? Well, Sarah, can you remind us sort of who stepped in or what the mechanism was that got the moratorium in place when COVID first became a reality in Detroit?
Yeah, that happened in March when the city and Governor Whitmer also stepped in and said, you know, obviously it became apparent that, you know, pushing hand washing and sanitation as being extremely important things to prevent the spread of COVID, that folks really needed water, and it would sort of be indefensible to cut people off in the midst of a pandemic. So that moratorium began in March, and they haven't shut off anyone since then, but those bills are not canceled. Like, people are still, you know, being charged for the water. They're just not having to pay it right now. So it was looking like after the end of this year, beginning of next year, they were going to start shutting people off again, you know, a significant number of people perhaps. But obviously, they've made this decision to continue the moratorium for the next couple of years. I think there are two things going on. One is just sort of the calculation that, you know, as the pandemic drags on, there's a public health rationale for continuing to not shut people off. But also, I think there's a political calculation involved at some level. It looks like Mayor Duggan is running for re-election, and this issue of the water shutoffs has been one that's been that activists and folks in town have been pretty persistently critical of him about. So it looks like they put together a way for at least the next 2 years to not shut folks off. I think the question now is what happens after that, and are they going to find a way to put into place a true water affordability plan so that people can afford their water bills and can pay them over, you know, a period of time.
Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick. Sarah, thank you so much.
No problem. Thank you.
As I mentioned, human rights activists and public health advocates have been working on water shutoffs in Detroit for years. Dr. Abdul El-Sayed is a former health director for the city of Detroit and has been an advocate on water issues of many kinds since then. Abdul, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you for having me, April.
You were part of the announcement with Mayor Duggan and the water department official, Gary Brown. When did you find out that the city was planning to extend the moratorium?
Well, this is an issue that so many folks have been working on for a long time. And, you know, water warriors who've been fighting literally for a decade now to address water justice in Detroit. And so really all the credit goes to them. But I had the opportunity to reach out to Mayor Duggan about what his plans were for his election campaign that is due to kick off for 2021. And I told him, I said, look, you know, we have an opportunity here to get right on an issue that has been really a bleeding wound in the city of Detroit for a long time. And you all have done some amazing work when it comes to putting a moratorium on water shutoffs in the city of Detroit. You've proven that it's possible to go all the way there. So why don't we do that? And got to talking about it and realized that there was a real opportunity to get this done. And so I worked with many of the activists to come together to talk about water shutoffs and a number of other challenges that that folks have been advocating on for a while. And this looked like one where we could get some real movement on. And so I was proud to join the mayor and DWSD director, Gary Brown, yesterday where they announced a moratorium through 2022 and an intent to fully end water shutoffs in Detroit. And so this really is a day to celebrate. And though there's a lot more work forward, I think this is the start we need.
Do you know how some of the people in Detroit who had their water shut off, how they were accessing water, what measures they went to get water to drink or to bathe with?
You know, unfortunately for a lot of folks, they had to rely on water donations in the form of bottled water. And others would connect through, you know, hoses with other community members. And still others would go and fill up buckets from neighbors and loved ones to bring home. But, you know, I'll never forget the first moment I saw what the consequences of a water shutoff looked like in real time. I was visiting a home where a baby had just passed and a mother who was grieving. And I had asked to use the bathroom. And when I tried to flush, I realized that I didn't hear that flush. And I looked over to the sink and saw water bottles just lining the sink and realized that this was a house that didn't have water. And when you see that and you think about the struggle of trying to bathe a small child without water, you start to appreciate what the human element of this looks like. And so, you know, for too many people, it's been a struggle for too long. And, you know, particularly in this moment of COVID-19, I really am grateful to the mayor and Director Brown and all the folks who've made that put an end to that kind of thing happening in the city.
Abdul, when you were running for governor a couple years back, you produced a plan that was sort of a 15,000-foot look at the problem. And as we've heard, sometimes there are situations where people's home plumbing is in such bad shape that turning the water back on doesn't really solve the problem. You know, they may still face high water bills because they have a lot of leaks in their pipes. What do you think might move the needle for some of the property owners in that situation?
Yeah, it's clear that the challenge with water isn't simply about water. After all, we live in a state that is blessed with more fresh water than any other state in the country. It's not just the water, it's the infrastructure that moves and cleans water that is such a challenge. And so how we pay for that is really important. And as you mentioned, for a lot of homes, people are dealing with the fact that they have very leaky plumbing that tends to spill a ton of water, for which then they are accountable to pay for. And so part of the solution here isn't just to end water shutoffs. It's to figure out how to make sure that we are fixing the plumbing in people's homes. And a number of folks have access to funds to be able to fix that plumbing. The city has been working hard on trying to do that, but it really is going to be critical for us as we think about putting a long-term end to these water shutoffs, as the mayor has announced an intention to do.
Dr. Abdul El-Sayed, former health director of the city of Detroit, and now an advocate on issues in Detroit, Flint, and elsewhere. Abdul, thanks very much.
April, thank you so much for having me, and thank you for talking about this really critical issue.
Monica Lewis Patrick is the president of We the People Detroit, and she's a human rights activist who has been right at the center of water shutoffs as one of Detroit's core issues. And she joins us now. Monica Patrick, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tell me, what was your reaction when you heard that the city was going to take this measure?
We have approached this issue with the mayor now for almost two decades with several prior administrations and with this particular mayor for over 6 years throughout his whole term. So really grateful to see that it took a global pandemic to finally move him in our direction that we must usher in water affordability, not only in the city of Detroit, but all across Michigan and the nation.
Indeed. Monica, I wanted to ask you a little bit about what you've seen as, you know, back in March when the city announced its water restart plan. It called for folks who wish to get their water turned back on via what was described as a streamlined process. Someone had to be there to let a water worker in to access the meter. And there was a charge, I want to say, in the neighborhood of $25 associated with the reconnection. And I just wondered if you have talked to or heard of anyone who's gone through the process.
As a matter of fact, I just got off a meeting with my director of Water Works here at We the People of Detroit. And so what we found is, yes, many people have signed up for programs, but they're not automatically enrolled in the $25 deferment plan. And we want to make sure people are clear on what that plan is. That plan is deeply connected to those CARES dollars that were allocated for COVID-19. That will allow you to be in a payment deferment plan during the time that there is still COVID dollars. So once those COVID dollars run out for that particular plan, there is no more funds. And that $25 is just to hold you into water assistance until the other side of COVID. And then all of that debt, all of that water usage, and all of that burden will come due at one time. And so we just see this as a Band-Aid on a gushing wound that we know in a matter of time is going to come due.
Have you had any indications from the city about what else might happen after 2022? I mean, I know it's impossible to say what the situation is going to be with respect to COVID, but were any assurances given that this issue would continue to get consideration?
Well, I've heard nothing any different than what I've heard in the past, which is getting folks to agree to sign themselves into unaffordable water plans that then will continue to give them a burden of debt that they will never be able to get from under. So without an amnesty component to this program, without the mayor seriously considering tie-barring any dollars for water infrastructure to a workforce development plan. And then I would just also offer that we often have to remind people that many of the architects and leaders of water affordability were birthed right here in this city. The late, great Marianne Mahaffey and the Honorable Councilwoman Joanne Watson were those legislative champions that created the first water affordability plan in the nation that Philadelphia and Baltimore are looking to. And it was these activists in Detroit, like People's Water Board and Michigan Welfare Rights and Sierra Club and Food and Water Watch, that came together with Charity Hicks, who's now deceased, and an ancestor, and the late Lila Cabell, who served Mother Rosa Parks. It was those women that have worked for almost two decades to then be the canary in the mine that we must solve this issue of unaffordable water rates. Water rates have gone up 438% in the last 20 years, but our wages have not kept pace with that. And the federal government has actually divested from water infrastructure. We saw in 1977, the federal government was contributing about 68 to 69% of the dollars that went into water infrastructure. They're now only contributing 7 to 9% of those dollars. So that gaping budgetary hole is landing on the backs of ratepayers, especially low wealth ratepayers that can't afford to pay.
After everything that you and others have been through with Detroit shutoffs, and after everything that activists in Flint have been through over the past few years, why do you think it's so hard to still have people see water as a basic human right?
Well, I would say in this state, in the state of Michigan, we have spent a lot of years racializing the issue around water equity, water justice, water access. And we don't tie bar it to the historical context of how we got here, that it was racialized policies in housing, and it was the inequities baked into employment and labor issues that led to white flight out of cities like Detroit and Flint, that then began to bake into policies in 1955 that legislated the city of Detroit to build out its infrastructure to 126 municipalities and townships. So as we built that system out, it also meant that we began to lose the number of taxpayers in our city, because those residents then abandoned the city of Detroit to move to where the jobs were. So when we look at all of that in historical context, there is no way that Michigan would have been able to survive and continue to thrive without the investment that Detroiters made. 40% of the state of Michigan gets its water from a well that the residents of Detroit built and still are indebted for. So to us, we see this as not only a Detroit issue, we see this as a Michigan issue. And we believe that water affordability can be solved not only in Detroit, but in Michigan, and we can be a model to the nation. I just think that it's going to be really important from both sides for the mayor to really understand that he is not going to be able to really get the full thrust of community participation and the wealth and the depth of knowledge. And I'm not just speaking of myself, I'm talking about activists that have been really supersede myself in this work. And it would really behoove him to put out that arm of friendship, that hand of friendship. It will benefit him, it will benefit the work. And then it also is important for us as activists to not be so entrenched in the fight for water that we forget that people are losing their lives because they don't have access to water right now. We are pushing for people to understand that we have an opportunity for Detroit to be the example, and we've got to move past egos and personalities. And we're giving the mayor a chance to really prove himself to be the leader that he claims to be, because he does not have a good track record of keeping these promises.
Monica Lewis Patrick is president of We the People Detroit. Monica, it's great to hear your voice. Thank you for talking to us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's Stateside for today. Thanks for listening. I'm April Baer. We'll see you tomorrow.